contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 10:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned, because here comes the bike show.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. You've just tuned into The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studios in southeast Portland, Oregon. I'm Terry Campbell here with fellow co-host Alon Robb. Morning, Alon.
Good morning. Happy independence from want and greed and homelessness and everything on this day.
I know you've been following the World Cup lately a little bit. Are you happy that England went through over Colombia yesterday, to just depart from the bike show for a second?
I always support the small countries with half-normal regimes. So Iceland was my favorite, and then Tunisia is pretty liberal in the Arab world. But now that they're out, may the best team win.
Fair enough. Thank you. On this Independence Day, we at the KBOO Bike Show wanted to honor our independence by sidestepping the narrative that we need to have adversarial relationships with our neighbors. Unlike the policies of our current executive branch or the views in popular media, I don't personally have a beef with either Mexico or Canada, and we thought this show could break through all the negative rhetoric by chatting with and learning from like-minded neighbors about cycling. You see, my feeling is if we just find things that we have in common, then you realize that other folks are striving for the same things in their community as we are striving for in ours. In these conversations, you will see that our neighbors aspire to improve cycling infrastructure, eliminate cyclist fatalities, and live in healthy cities. Our hope with this show is that as the news starts to paint a certain narrative based on the actions of some people in Washington, D.C., you will remember our guests on this show and their stories. So with that, I would like to introduce Jeff Lee is going to join us from Hub Cycling in Vancouver, Canada, in the first half of the show. And during the second half of the show, we're going to have a conversation with Daniel Gomez Pinto and Elizabeth Hensley Cheney of Alianza por Movilidad Activa AC in Tijuana, Mexico. So with that, I'd like to introduce Jeff Lee, Vice President of Hub Cycling. Hub Cycling is a charitable nonprofit organization based, established in 1998 to improve cycling conditions in Metro Vancouver. Jeff lives in downtown Vancouver and cycles locally while also enjoying cycling trips abroad. He believes that cycling for transportation can best be increased by ensuring people have access to safe infrastructure and that people feel safe while cycling. In Jeff's opinion, working to promote these goals is Hub's most valuable contribution. This work includes advocating for improvements at all levels of government and celebrating their successes. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe just give us a little bit of background on yourself first here. What are some of your earliest cycling memories, and how did you get into biking? Was it a lot of folks kind of harken back to a day when they were little kids racing brothers and sisters or neighbors down the street. Maybe give us a little insight into your personal journey.
That's where it started for me. Grade one was walking to school, and by grade two, I was cycling to school in a group of neighborhood kids, and that carried on until I was 15 or 16. It included bikes for paper routes to carry papers. It included shops to, trips to the store and just for fun. During university years, it was recreation. It was also fitness. And I guess that what happened is, like many of us, I got busy with mortgages and kids and work, and cycling slipped away a little bit. I rode occasionally, but I looked up one year and thought, geez, you know, I need to get back into this. I need the fitness. It's a practical way of getting around. And about 2005, I really got back into cycling myself. Really just as a personal decision that I missed it. I'd slipped away from it. And from that, I began to ride more and more. I began to ride more for transportation. I was already a member of Hub Cycling, but I became involved as a volunteer. And when I retired several years back, I went to Hub and suggested that they put me to work. They could probably afford me now that I was retired, and I'd like to see what I could do. So that was it.
Well, good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being on the show. An article in the Seattle Times was titled, "As Seattle Struggles with Bike Lanes, Vancouver, BC Has Won the Battle." And the first sentence is, "Seattle bike advocates gaze longingly at Vancouver." Is the picture that rosy?
It isn't that rosy. I think the conversation has definitely shifted here. I think that headline was perhaps a little optimistic. There's more than one Vancouver, BC. There is the city of Vancouver, which is the downtown core, and about 600,000 people. And then there is Metro Vancouver, which is 23 municipalities, all titled Metro Vancouver, but they're the suburbs. And I would say that we have far more success in the downtown core than we do in Metro Vancouver. But in the downtown core, we are seeing far less opposition to cycling infrastructure than we saw a few years back. We recall going to public hearings about a proposal for a new bike lane on a city street, and someone saying, well, they're going to take out the parking, and it was going to make it worse for cars. And the common phrase we used was Carmageddon. It will all just grind to a halt. And when we were involved in those hearings 4 and 5 years ago, we would typically see a public hearing in front of the city council extend to 3 or 4 nights so all 400 or 500 speakers could say how bad or how good it was. And I contrast that with a couple of years back when we put a separated lane, and the city put a separated lane across our Burrard Bridge, and there were about 8 speakers and at that open house, or that public hearing. And of those 8 speakers, most of them were talking about the artistic changes to a bridge that is an Art Deco style more than the cycling. And so we thought, well, that's important. And this most recent one was a few months back, and we had a proposal to put a separated lane across a low-level bridge across False Creek. And it's a 6-lane bridge, and they wanted to take one lane away, and the city pointed out that at the far end of the bridge, it went down to 2 lanes there anyway. So it wasn't like it was going to affect throughput or car capacity. But it was still, it got some attention. And we sent a paper into, a proposal paper in, but we got a call from the city manager asking if we were not registered to speak. And we said no. We thought we had presented our position, but we could. He said it would be a good idea if you came to speak. And we said, fine. So we registered and we made it to speak. And as it turned out, for that momentous evening, there were 3 speakers and all of us were in favor. So people have stopped coming out to protest. They have... When the news reporters have met with, you know, on the site during construction, saying they're blocking traffic, what do you think of this? And a lot of the people in the street are saying, well, it looks pretty good to me. So the tone has definitely changed. And I wouldn't say that there's no opposition, but there's been a tipping point within our downtown core that cycling infrastructure is now recognized as not being a Carmageddon event. It's simply part of the fabric of the city.
And can you tell our listeners who might be more familiar with Vancouver, Washington, a little bit about the city and the region? Besides the high rents and prices, what distinguishes the city and its population?
And what makes it also challenging for riding a bike?
Well, Vancouver is, you know, again, we have to point out that there's the downtown core is generally pretty flat. When you go into the suburbs, you start to get into the mountains or you get into some of the hills on the North Shore. That's where mountain biking came from, Grouse Mountain and Frome Mountain many years back. And what we see there is lots of hills and more challenges, But if you go south of Vancouver into those suburbs, it's on the Fraser River Delta, so it's completely flat. It's, you know, it's a little bit like Copenhagen. It's more sun and less rain because it's away from the mountains a little bit, and it's an agricultural area with a complete tabletop. So we have areas that are better for cycling and areas with hills that are more more of a challenge. We also have within the downtown core a very attractive city and attractive for people to move to, attractive for people to live here. So we have challenges around housing affordability. We have challenges around we've become an international destination, not simply a Canadian destination, and that means that we're getting some disconnects in between real estate pricing and local wages, and that has created challenges for people who live here. So one of the aspects of that is that transportation needs to be considered together with the cost of accommodation, and cycling and walking and transit are more affordable alternatives than owning a vehicle. So Vancouver is struggling with these pressures, but is working to create sort of town centers that have less driving between them and more walking, cycling, and transit to reduce the cost pressures for people, and cycling certainly a part of that.
Hub Cycling is a nonprofit, as we would classify it down here in the States. Broadly speaking, or you could go into some detail, how do you guys affect change on some of that, and do you operate in it sounds like in the whole Metro Vancouver area, so that's a big area to stay on top of, right?
We cover 23 municipalities, yeah. And Hub really has two separate groups under the Hub banner, all under the same board, and we have elections every year, and we have a board of directors. What we have in our staff group, and our staff is usually runs in between 12 to 15 people, not counting instructors who are over that. That 12, 15, or 16 people are involved in programs, in events, and education. So education is bike education in the schools, bike education for adult courses, learn to ride courses, working with new immigrant groups, specific new immigrant courses for cycling and how to get around Vancouver by bike. The events include things like our Bike the Night Festival, our Bike Shorts Film Festival. We have all sorts of events that try and celebrate or promote cycling for transportation. And then the programs are things like Bike to School Week, Bike to Work Week, and other events that are continuous two or three times a year, but where we really make a point that it's possible to ride to work. We work on end-of-trip facilities with developers and with city councils. We have celebration stations during Bike to Work Week. In our most recent Bike to Work Week, we had about 12,000 participants, and those 12,000 participants logged 540,000 kilometers, so just over 300,000 miles in the 5 days. We do that with corporate sponsorship, with municipalities funding our planning efforts, and then we staff those booths with volunteers. So that's the staff side of how we affect change. We're celebrating successes, we're drawing attention, and we are letting people see people riding, whether it's bike to shop or bike to work or bike to school.
And also go ahead about the advocacy. That was going to be my question.
So the second half of what Hub does is advocacy, advocating for improved infrastructure. And as a nonprofit, we do our advocacy with a volunteer group, not with our paid staff. So what we are doing with our volunteers is we have a local committee, and we call them local action committees. We have 10 of them covering the 23 municipalities, and as well as one regional committee. And those committees, and I chair the Vancouver committee, so that's the downtown Vancouver core and the University of British Columbia, which is the campus adjoining the downtown core. What we do there is we are identifying opportunities. We're saying here's a space or a gap in the network. And one of our public facing campaigns is hashtag ungap the map. And Ungap the Map is a public-facing campaign where we say, here's where the bike routes are, but here's a critical gap between them. And what the committees are trying to do is identifying latent demand, figuring out where, if we build it, they would come. It's no sense spending all the money to build a bike lane where there isn't need for it, but we try and figure out where it's most needed based upon its utility, based upon its practicality, based upon its political will and funding available. And we list all of these gaps, and then we advocate with local government agencies, whether they be municipal or our provincial, which your state level, or a regional planning authority, which covers all of Metro Vancouver, but is planning, not construction. And we work with those groups to promote building safe routes to places that matter. We used to see a lot of local street bikeways about 20 years ago, where commerce streets away from traffic were designated as bike routes. And in many cases, it didn't consist of much more than calling it a bike route and possibly painting some shared arrows or sharrows on the roadway to say, this is a bike route now. And that worked to get people started, but it didn't take people where they wanted to go. It didn't take them to shops. It didn't take them to restaurants. It didn't take them to schools. And so what we have been working on is building more routes that support things like shopping and restaurant visits and so on. That's often because of the traffic volumes that we're often built looking at protected lanes or separated lanes to get cycling more visible off those side streets where it's two streets away from the arterial and back into the main core where people want to get to.
Nice. And is the funding provided by the city council, the British Columbia's government, or the federal level? And how much is the funding affected by shifts in leadership?
So the funding for construction all comes from all of those, and I can speak to those. So, you know, we don't build anything ourselves. We are the most of the roads will be built by the municipal authorities, the city, and their funding is from their tax base. So there we work on economic arguments about the cost of a bike lane and how it can move people more effectively than a motor vehicle lane. Those investments vary by city council. The city of Vancouver has a quite progressive council who have been very supportive. Certainly there will be an election this October, and we'll work to make sure that we find some candidates who are going to continue that work. Throughout the 23 municipalities, there is a variance. There are some municipalities who see less reason to invest in cycling. And we have to work to on education as much as on picking the routes. It's like the reasons for building them, not just which route should you build. When we go to the Regional Planning Authority, they have money to that comes from taxes and comes from their funding sources on development and so on, and they use that to incent the local municipalities to build strategic routes. And so they will fund 50 or 75% of a bike route if it meets their standards for all ages and ability. And for specific routes, then municipalities can tap into this regional funding to build more or to build further. The province has limited involvement in supporting cycling. There are two or three key areas. The first is that they have a co-funding program that is focused more on rural municipalities and on provincial highways or your state highways, where they will look to provide alternate routes if they have a bridge crossing a particular river or a major highway. That's called Bike BC funding, and it is co-funding with the local authorities, but it's a certain pot of money. We do not have federal co-funding. That's something that we look longingly to the states at and say, wouldn't that be nice if we had federal support for some of these initiatives? And it's something we don't have today.
Do you have you seen in your time with the hub and have you seen an increase in interest from all levels of government in this and sort of new allotments of resources or...
We are seeing an increased uptake, increased interest. Again, it varies with sort of the political group and so on. We had a new federal government a couple of years back, the Liberals under Trudeau. The Environment Minister and the Health Minister there have been interested in talking to us about the need for a national cycling strategy and the need for federal support. And we've done rides with the federal Environment Minister, who has come to Vancouver and done a public event with us to promote that. We've had a change in our provincial government a year and a half back, and that provincial government is currently an alliance of our Social Democrat Party and our Green Party. And so those two have been more supportive than our previous slightly more conservative provincial government was. And what we've seen there is increased interest from both the environment group, the transportation group, and we're working hard to connect it through to the health ministry, because we think there's huge benefits in healthcare costs. And since healthcare costs here are largely funded by government, we think the government should be highly interested in public health related to better transportation choices.
You're listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon, on the web at www.kboo.fm. We're on the phone with Jeff Lee of Hub Cycling in Vancouver. And Jeff, you just touched on a subject that I remember reading a report out of UBC about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and it had to do with cycling in urban areas and potential ill effects to health due to car exhaust and other air pollutants. Are you familiar with the report? And is that something that's talked about more up there because the research was done out of UBC?
We actually have had pretty good support out of UBC. They have a research program in the School of Public Health, Public and Population Health, called Cycling in Cities. And they talk about things like the choice of route and location. And so I'm not sure if it was one of their studies that you're referring to. It might have been an engineering study related to pollutants at ground level out of the engineering department out there. But what we look at is... you don't necessarily want to build a major bike route along a route that is heavily congested. Sometimes getting a little bit away from that traffic can pay some benefits. We do talk to the group at UBC about the public health benefits and the design of routes that promote public health. And a lot of their research has been about motivating people to cycle, and their research shows very clearly that the biggest reason that people don't cycle is that they don't feel safe doing so. So we talk about the safety of certain routes, but we also talk about the perceived safety and does it feel safe. And you know, we do all sorts of things to measure that perception. The UBC group has been good at promoting gender measurements. And if we look at a route that you would say, well, only the road warriors are using that, you know, you'd have to be pretty brave to want to go down that bike route. There's a lot of traffic. One of the things you can do is count the male-female split that is using that route, and then you look at in doing improvements to that route, and if you do those improvements and it feels better, you'll find that you can bring the gender balance back much closer to 49-51 or 50-50. And I think what we found through the research is that some people are adrenaline junkies and will ride there anyway, and some are making personal decisions on where they ride based on their feelings of safety, and there's often a gender association with that. So we've got good support out of that group at UBC in terms of trying to figure out how to identify when people feel safe and what types of routes, whether they be protected lanes or off-street paths or whatever.
Yeah, and speaking of the future, the city has a transportation 2040 plan. It's a long-term vision. Where do bicycles fit into that? What is the budget allocated? And are you optimistic about this plan?
So the Transportation 2040 plan was adopted by the City of Vancouver in 2012, and it set out basically a 30-year vision for a 30-year target. And it, one of the things it's good about is it measures mode share and sets interim targets. So there were targets set that the city wanted to reduce its reliance on single-occupant vehicles and on vehicles as a primary source of trips, and increase transit, increase walking, and increase people on bikes. And that was not for recreation, that was for transportation trips. So that plan has been quite good in terms of measuring the progress along the way. We have now had 2 years in a row, the 15 and 16 plan report. We haven't seen the 17 yet, but active transportation is now counted at over 50% of trips in the city of Vancouver, and that means transit, bike, and walk are greater than 50% of the trips made, and vehicles are down to about 49%. Bike is further measured in terms of the number of people who choose to bike to work as their primary method of getting to work, and the city of Vancouver is just over 10%, very close to 10% now, and has been for 2 years. That's basically doubled over the last few years. We were at 4 and 5% for a few years. So we're seeing the effects both of having a long-term vision, of making the investments in safer bike routes, and then measuring the progress towards it. And so we're quite optimistic about that. The city had a target when it wanted to get these numbers, and it was 2020, and we achieved it in 2016. So 4 years ahead of plan, they achieved their 50% target, and the first thing that happened was to set some new interim targets, say, where do we want to get to by 2020? And we're working with the city to establish an interim bike target for 2020, because, again, we've already met the 2020 target. We need something to shoot for here.
Nice. That's great. That's great. So if someone from Portland came up to Vancouver on vacation or to stop by and visit, what kind of experience would they have as far as you know, do you have a bike share program? Should they bring their own bike? Are there maps like readily available of the different share-o routes?
Yeah, we have a there are maps readily available, and what we're seeing increasingly is hotels in the downtown core having bicycle concierges and free bikes at the hotels. Because if you have a downtown hotel and you're on a bike route, it's a very easy thing to attract people to. It doesn't take much investment on the part of a hotel. So we're seeing more of that. There are maps readily available, and there's wayfinding signs on all of the major routes showing how they connect. If you're in the city of Vancouver as opposed to the suburbs, you should look for the protected bike lanes and make a point of riding them and seeing how they work. And it's not just protected lanes, but protected intersections with separate phasing for bikes and for people turning, so we don't get the conflicts at the intersections. In terms of a bike, Vancouver has a long history of having rental bike shops. And so for tourists, one of the best things to do is to go to one of our bike rental places downtown and rent a bike for the day or for a half day. And that works very well. We do have a bike share system. It's about 1,500 bikes now at 150 stations. It's not oriented towards tourist traffic. You need a membership in it, and you can buy a one-day pass, but they're really designed as one-way drop-offs and 30-minute trips. And so it's now it's doing quite well in the downtown area, our bike share. It's certainly possible to use it, but people often want to ride more than a half hour and click a bike back into a dock or take it away, and it becomes quite expensive if you take one of those bikes out for a half day. So if you're doing a short trip downtown, the bike share is called Mobi, M-O-B-I, and it works very well. You'll see them all around downtown. The stations are about 200 meters apart, 200 yards apart. The bike shops that have rentals cater more to a visitor who wants a bike for 4 hours. And the iconic thing to do in Vancouver is to ride around our seawall. We have a separated bike path that goes around Stanley Park and around the seawall, and it's a 28-kilometer loop if you do the whole length, but you can do sections of it. And it's a it's something to experience in Vancouver, riding the seawall and seeing what's here.
Cool.
Our time is almost up. It's hard to believe, but if I may ask you a personal question, I noticed on the website among all the capable staff members and board members that you were the vice president of Feening International, the world's largest distributor of Caterpillar products and support systems. I find it interesting that, you know, you were dealing with large machinery and now the modest bicycle. Are there any points where the two meet or any lessons that you're bringing from your work in that big company to the bicycle world?
When I first started volunteering with Hub, I wondered what my previous work career, how it would apply and how it fit, because I thought, you know, I don't know a lot about building bike lanes. I do tend to understand some of the groups who are doing the actual construction, because my company supplied the equipment to them, the Caterpillar equipment went to. So there were some links there. But what I quickly learned is there were a huge number of transferable points. In my previous career, I led a project management team and project management office, and I led IT projects as well as working with the equipment. And we had large change projects. So if you're doing a large IT project in a company with 12,000 employees, it's really about effecting change within the organization. And those skills transferred very well across to what we're trying to do with cycling. We're not saying that everyone needs to ride a bike, but we believe that everyone should have the opportunity to. And that means giving them the facilities and the infrastructure that they feel safe doing it, supporting them along the way. And a lot of the things that we did in those big change projects within a corporation come across very closely, and I'm an engineer by training who worked with a lot of big equipment, but that also means that I can understand how some of the construction happens and how some of the challenges faced by the teams when they go to design a bike route.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, Jeff, as Alan said, we're pretty much out of time. But before we depart, could you share with our listeners any social media or website addresses where they could do a bit more research on Hub Cycling and cycling around Vancouver?
Yeah, certainly. If you want to find out more about Hub, please check out our website, which is bikehub.ca, and that links you to both our committee work, it links you to our events, it links you to our others. We are on Twitter at @WeAreHub. We have our campaign about filling in the gaps called hashtag ungap the map that is being promoted. But if you go to the website, it links you to our Instagrams, it links you to our all of our different social media feeds, and that's probably the best way of getting there. So that was bikehub.ca, and we'd love to see you up here.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the time today.
Thank you very much.
And we'll see you in Vancouver.
Okay, and I'll see you in Portland. Take
that
care.
Sounds good. Thanks,
thank you.
Jeff.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Stay tuned. During the second part of the show, we'll be joined by Daniel Gomez Patino and Elizabeth Hensley Cheney in Tijuana, Mexico. We've been joined by Daniel Gomez Patino and Elizabeth Hensley Cheney in Tijuana, Mexico. Daniel and Elizabeth are bike mobility advocates based in the city of Tijuana, Baja California Norte, who work in the urban areas of Abajalito, California. Daniel was born in Chilagolande, registered in Jalisco, and has lived in Tijuana since he was 3 months old. Elizabeth grew up in rural parts of the Mid-Atlantic United States and has been based in the Tijuana-San Diego region since 2009. They met at a conference on active mobility that took place in TJ in 2011. Later, forming part of a collective known as Alianza por el Ciclismo y una Ciudad Más Humana. It was from that the collective Alianza por la Movilidad Activa AC, a civil society organization that studies conditions around walking and cycling in the binational metropolitan zone, was formed. Daniel and Elizabeth, welcome to the show, and please correct my Spanish grammar on either of your organization's names.
Está bien. Muchas gracias por tenernos. Thank you very much for having us.
Gracias.
Good morning.
So maybe give us a little bit of background on the organizations that you guys are involved in and some of the activities that you do.
Okay, so I guess Alianza por la Movilidad Activa, Asociación Civil, is an organization that was formed from Alianza por el Ciclismo en la Ciudad Más Humana, a collective that was put together, to be honest, in relation to an event called Tijuaneando en Bici that started in 2011. In that year, a number of people from civil society were invited by the Metropolitan Planning Institute to participate in a binational event that was connected to Bike to Work Day in San Diego. This was something that had been proposed, I think, by Hector Vanegas, who works with the Borders Program of the San Diego Association of Governments. And from there, I guess this event served as a platform to bring people together to talk about what is it to ride a bicycle in the city of Tijuana in the binational region, in the zona fronteriza de San Diego, Tijuana.
And good morning, both of you. This is Alon. Before we go further with details about the organization, can you tell us a little bit about the city itself, the geography, population? As you know, information about Mexico and the United States is very poor. So.
Andale. It's something that's curious. I guess in this region, there's always, since I have lived here, there's been a lot of interest in trying to find ways to hermanar or to sort of bring together the two cities. They have to coexist, but there are definitely barriers to that. I guess the city of Tijuana is pretty young. The date of the city.
Para empezar, tenemos un clima mediterráneo.
Bueno, pero es otro asunto.
Permite.
Bueno. So, I guess the city can be traced back to a plan that was drawn up in 1877.
Nine.
Muy bien. That was drawn up in 1889 by an engineer that was contracted by La Familia Arguello to provide a plan for a property that they had in the northern part of Baja California. And this was known as the Plan de Zaragoza. And the city, has sort of traced its birth date to the origin of this plan, the Plan de Zaragoza. So we are a little bit over 100 years old, pretty young for a city.
No somos una ciudad real ni con un camino real.
Ándale. I guess we're not a royal city, nor do we have a royal path or a camino real.
And what is the population of the city and the area around it?
Well, it's an interesting question because INEGI, which would be like the equivalent of the Census Bureau in the United States, the census that was completed in 2010 indicates that the city has a population of around 1,850,000. However, other estimates of the city population range between 4 and 6 million. This has a lot to do with what's called the población flotante, or people who are passing through the city, who don't technically, or people who live in the city but aren't registered as such.
Interesting. What sort of topography is it? I mean, I know it's on the sort of coastline, but is it mountainous, or is cycling around there, is that challenging, or is it flat?
Because in Tijuana, you can use a bicycle in zones. We're like the city of San Diego. We're a network of canyons. The city is built atop a network of canyons, and so like in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So the topography can be pretty challenging, but in zones, it's something that's totally feasible. I can remember, for example, in 2014, the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy realized a workshop, Ciclos Ciudades, in Tijuana. One of the things that they recommended in that workshop was that, connecting the city as a whole, it would be important to think about intermodality. Like, bicycles can be something that work within in sections of the city, within delegaciones, for example, which are different sort of like districts within the city. But to connect the city at large, it's going to be important to use several different modes of transportation, like bicycles and buses, for example.
And I'm curious, before we go into detail about the organization and the work that you're doing, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your own backgrounds? Were you always cyclists?
I guess I can say on my part, so in 2006, when I was in undergraduate, I was on my way to a job interview. I stopped at an intersection for an emergency vehicle to pass. Someone behind me was, writing on their phone, rear-ended me. The car was totaled. I wasn't hurt. I wound up going to the interview with tears on my face. I didn't get the job.
Oh, no.
But after that, I wasn't able to move from where I lived to the place where I was going to school in a vehicle, so I started walking. And one of the things that I found really amazing about walking was I could finally get to know the area that was surrounding me. In that case, walking, I guess, three or so miles was a fair amount of time, so bicycling was a happy medium between walking and moving about in other ways. Since then, it's been my principal way of getting around.
And Daniel, what is your background with bicycles?
¿Cuál es tu fondo con la bicicleta? I'm going to help translate.
Mis primeras novias fueron bicicletas.
Daniel says his first girlfriends were bicycles.
That's the best answer I've ever heard.
Sí, a mis 55 años yo fui pionero del BMX en sur de California.
From the standpoint of being a person with 55 years, he was someone who participated a lot with BMX in Southern California when that was just sort of starting up.
That's great. He's still riding today around the city as well.
Que sigues como andando en la ciudad? Well, sí, por supuesto que sí.
Sí, traigo mi Schwinn 1978 en buen estado.
Daniel has a Schwinn from 1970
mountain bike.
78, a mountain bike that he uses to get around. To be honest, it winds up being for trips that are less than say maybe 10 miles, it's just quicker to get around on a bicycle. Mm-hmm. They're less stressful.
How, in your time, in the organization's time since 2011, what kind of progress has been made in Tijuana around infrastructure improvements and making new or wannabe cyclists more comfortable and safe with the activity?
So, up to this point, in Tijuana, there are two formal pieces of infrastructure that exist. There's work that's starting on a plan, or an integrated plan for sustainable urban mobility. The two pieces of infrastructure, one goes along a boulevard called the Boulevard Benitez, which is a pretty heavily transited street. Curiously, there's a sort of misperception that it's not very well used. However, there was one time we were doing bicycle counts, and we counted approximately in the period between 6 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock, around two cyclists passing every minute. There's a lot of work to do, and some things are getting started, which is promising, but there's a lot of need to push. To pressure.
And does the city have a master plan, like, you know, many cities? We just heard from Jeff Lee of the Vancouver, British Columbia Bicycle Coalition. The city over there has a 2040 transportation plan. Is there a similar one in Tijuana?
That's something that's just getting started through the Integrated Plan for Sustainable Urban Mobility, or Plan Integral de Movilidad Urbana Sustentable, as it's known in Spanish. I know that up to this point, work has happened update sort of a diagnosis about what are the conditions of the streets in Tijuana. This plan is looking at a more sort of broad panorama of transportation solutions, including the bicycle, including walking, including mass transportation.
What are the conditions like if I was to come down to Tijuana? You guys offer bike tours, I understand, and so what types of bikes would you be riding on for that? And what are the road conditions as far as under the tire? Okay.
Talking about street conditions?
Yeah, street conditions, other transportation, other forms of... I had a friend who went to Mexico City a few years ago and was riding his bike, and I know Mexico City's far away, but he found it that it was much more, there was a lot more, it was more chaotic, but he felt safer because he felt like within the chaos, there was sort of a respect for cyclists equal to a bus for a cab driver, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so
There wasn't that adversarial relationship that you sort of get here in Portland sometimes between a car driver and a cyclist, that even though it was kind of chaotic, he felt more safe, which is interesting.
I think in Tijuana, what we found is that it makes the most, like, if you know the streets of the city, you can get around on a bicycle fairly easily. With that said, that means avoiding, streets that have a high volume of motorized transit. So we call it in Tijuana callejoneando, or sort of taking smaller streets. And that way, there's a fair amount of connectivity within the city. I'm thinking about, attitudes on the part of, there are very few people who want to kill people, who want to kill other people on bicycles when they're in a car. There's some degree of respect, but I think that the volume of traffic is so great that it can produce a conflicting situation.
Mm-hmm. And Mexico's been in the news recently quite a lot, both because the football team unfortunately lost to Brazil, my condolences, but also because of the election. AMLO, the new president, is a declared leftist. I was encouraged by reading about the new mayor of Mexico City, the first woman, Claudia Sheinbaum, who's a former student activist and environmental scientist. Do you see these leading to concrete changes, the way people and the government view cycling?
Yes, que está preguntando si vemos como los cambios políticos que pueden producir cambios concretos.
Sociales, sí.
Sí. I mean, it seems like we think that there's, certainly I think with Andrés Manuel, he's a figure whom there's some degree of skepticism about him, which I think that puts civil society in a position to be vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone who's going to be open and more responsive to civil society than more recent gobernantes more recent authorities have been. So it's definitely an exciting moment.
And in Mexico City, do you have faith in the new mayor and her administration?
Está comentando de la alcaldesa de la Ciudad de México y la administración allá, si tenemos como algo de fe en la nueva administración.
Hay muchos aliados que van a empujar.
Sí, there are a lot of allies that can help push.
La ley de seguridad vial.
For example, the law on roadway security, which was something that had been proposed. And if you've spoken with Arely Carrion, at some point, she and other people with Bicitecas in Ciudad de México had been pushing this initiative for a law to promote greater roadway security, to promote consideration of different modes of transportation and the protection to modes that are more vulnerable, walking, biking. So there may be some opening to be able to promote that law.
¿Cuándo va a ser el evento? ¿En 2020? ¿El bicycle?
¿Velocity? Mm-hmm. Sí. We know that, for example, Ciudad de México will be hosting an edition of Velocity in, I think, 2020, which can be also something, it can be a way to push.
That's great. Your website informs us that your goal is to advance more human cityscapes through the study of non-motorized urban mobility, seeking to impulse projects and programs that promote harmonious coexistence between inhabitants as we interact on the city streets. Could you expand on your goals and sort of some activities you guys have been working on recently to kind of achieve those outcomes?
Well, I think one of the things that we try to be, conscious of, we don't want to see ourselves as cyclists versus other forms of transportation. Firstly, we're all people. That's something that we have to be conscious of. One of the things that we've been working on to try to achieve or promote the goal that you just mentioned, working in coordination with a colony in the city called the Colonia Libertad, different neighbors, we've started to form plans for an event for a Vía Recreativa to take place in early September. The idea with the Vía Recreativa is to limit vehicular access to the streets
and open them to neighbors and families coming together to socialize. We've been really fortunate to be able to be connected with the parroquia, with the community group in the Colonia Libertad, who've been, really important for being able to socialize and closer with neighbors. The Via Recreativa is going to take place on Sunday, the 2nd of September, from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m.
And that'll be an opportunity for the city street to be closed down to motorized vehicles. I know that's common in other Central South American countries where on any Sunday, it's just there's plazas open for like you said, for friends and neighbors to congregate and bike and walk. Is that sort of the model there for that event in September?
Exactly. And I think what you're talking about, for example, the example that's always cited is Bogota, mm-hmm. Colombia, where I think 70-something kilometers of streets are closed down to vehicular traffic to be used as public spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I think in cities today, we lack spaces that are really public. When you ask someone what's a public space, maybe the first thing that comes to mind is a shopping mall, which is not a public space. It's not a publicly funded space. And it's a space where the public can congregate, but it's for the purpose of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Streets are one of the few spaces that we have that are publicly funded. Yet there's often, we don't often in a social way. We think of them about moving goods, moving people, but not as a space to socialize. Okay. And it's interesting to try to retake these spaces for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And what is, do you have any coordination? Do you work together with the San Diego Bike Coalition? And also, speaking of the border, are there any plans for cross-border bike lane? What is it like can you ride from San Diego to Tijuana or Tijuana to San Diego?
I mean, it's definitely feasible. There's an interesting history there. Okay, so prior to 2000, if you were going to cross the international boundary on a bicycle, you would just be part of the traffic lanes or the traffic lanes that receive automobiles. So you could cross on a bicycle like you do on a motorcycle. I think from 2000 to 2005, there was a designated lane for bicycles to cross at through the pedestrian port of entry. It was a preferential lane, so bicyclists could head to the head of the queue. After September 11th, when the crossing lines became much longer due to tightened security protocols, There had been a person who had a pretty smart idea for a business, renting bicycles to people who wanted to cross more quickly. We understand that in 2005, the Internal Revenue Service approached this person who had their business in Mexico to request that they pay taxes to the United States for business based in Mexico. He said, well, no, my business is not, I mean, this is not relevant to my business. And so it seemed like, from what we understand, the response was that the preferential lane was shut down. Since then, there have been efforts to try to propose reopening another lane like this, as a form of encouraging bicycle mobility. At the port of entry, are you familiar with the San Ysidro port of entry?
Not so much.
So the San Ysidro port of entry is the busiest land port of entry on Earth. Vehicular queues can last up, 4 to 6 hours. All the while that automobiles are waiting in line, that they're stalling, they're producing gases that are pretty toxic.
Mm-hmm.
In one way, it's something that's a great concern to communities near the zona fronteriza, whether in Tijuana or in San Diego County. And so we need to try to I guess, sort of try to reduce the number of crossings that are happening in, on private automobiles, particularly those that are gas or diesel powered, to try to reduce some of these gases and the effects that they're going to have on public health, the effects that they're having and going to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that what, like, currently the San Ysidro Port of Entry is undergoing a green renovation. Green, I would put in quotation marks. I guess the building that's going to be constructed to receive pedestrians is LEED Platinum certified. However, at the same time, they're going to increase capacity at the vehicular port of entry, so they're going to be able to receive more automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that's happened in relation to the port of entry reconstruction, so SANDAG and also working with the San Ysidro Chamber of Commerce were able to lobby with GSA, with General Services Administration, which is the agency that designs and constructs port of entry facilities, so that there are two pedestrian facilities that are, I guess, one that's operating and one that's getting ready to operate as part of the new, or the San Ysidro Green Renovation Project. The facility that's currently operating, which is called San Ysidro Western Pedestrian Facility, or PED West, It has 14 booths to receive people. GSA built the facility with the idea that one of the booths would receive people who are coming in on bicycles, in combination with people who are coming in with a mobility limitation, so people who are crossing with a walker, or people who are crossing in a wheelchair. The agency that operates the facility never developed a protocol to receive people like as such.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't operated up to this point. There's a need for pressure. And it's always like thinking about how things are with the federal government in the United States. It seems like there's going to need to be a change in personalities in order to be able to propose and successfully implement changes.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that for sure. Well, I'm not sure where the time went, Daniel and Elizabeth, but we're running close to the end of the hour here, and I would really appreciate both of you being with us. Is there, before we leave you today, is there a place our listeners can find out more about cycling in Tijuana? A website or social media platforms?
Well, I can say, I guess we have a Facebook page, Alianza por la Movilidad Activa. There are more than 80 different paseos or 80 different groups that promote cycling within the city of Tijuana. There's Paseo Ciclopista, Paseo Viernes en Pedales. There's a lot of information out there if people are interested to look for it. If it would be useful, I can send some links your way via email, if you'd like to post them on your website.
We could certainly do that. That would be great.
Okay, awesome.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much to both of you. And if you ever make it to Portland, you're welcome to visit and be hosted by us. And all the best to you.
And gracias.
Thank
gracias.
You very much. And this is also the last show that Terry will co-host. We are sorry to see you leave, Terry. It has been a true pleasure working with you. We will really miss you. But I know you're on to a lot of great future projects, so good luck with that. And this is also the time to mention that the current hosts, Tori, April, and I, would welcome new members to our team. So we can't promise the conventional fame and fortune, but there are many rewards of the more spiritual kind. And if you're interested, please check our site, www.kbu.fm/program/bikeshow for more details.
Thank you, Alan. Yeah, this is going to be my last show, and it's been a great pleasure working with these folks, and I'm still going to be around in the Portland area, so I'm here to help. But so today, you've been listening to the KBU Bike Show from Portland, Oregon, which airs on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived by bikeshow.portlandtransport.com.
The Bike Show is produced by Terry Bortman, Alon Robb, April Streeter, and myself, Terry Campbell. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, for doing a great job on a holiday, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guests, Jeff Lee of Hub Cycling in Vancouver, BC, and Daniel Gomez-Patino and Elizabeth Hensley-Cheney in Tijuana, Mexico. We'll be back next month with more great bike news. Until then, keep your wheels down.
You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail. You can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle. You can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus. You can take it on a train. Take a ride to the water. You can take a ride anywhere you want to. Everybody, ride your bicycle.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th. And 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip-hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip-hop programming, how hip-hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme, writing, and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip-Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting the return of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones with David Grisman Trio and Jerry Douglas Band. That's Saturday, July 14th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Tickets and more information at zooconcerts.com. And you want to stay tuned because coming up next is the live broadcast of the Blues Festival, Downtown Waterfront Blues Festival. You're going to want to hang on and listen to that. We'll hear a little bit of music to lead us into that. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. Stand by.